All right, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 5 of Justice with Jax. And I am so pleased to have an esteemed guest today, once co-defendant and still I consider a colleague, Alex Archuleta. And so today is Saturday, April 13th, 2024. It is 257 days since the case Armendariz and Chinook Center versus the City of Colorado Springs et al. Has been filed. And so Alex, tell the people who you are.
Hi, everybody. Happy to be here. I'm excited that Jax invited me to this. I think this is really cool to have a podcast like this. So I'll just give you like a quick summary of
your
me, I guess. Yeah, my
yes.
affiliations, my CV, I guess. So I teach history and humanities at UCCS. I'm a lecturer there. I teach mainly civil rights type stuff. Chicano movement is big. I'm one of the few people that does teach that at all,
hell
unfortunately.
Yeah. We're going to change. We'll work on that.
Right.
A few things to work on.
And then also I sit on the board and was a founding member of the Chinook Center, which is the product of a lot of these conversations, I imagine. But yeah, I sit on the board for that and was involved in the chaos of the protest that took place. How long ago?
Well, the protest itself, I guess that's July 31, 2021. And
that's
then
it all started.
Time.
I think I met you then. That was the first time I met you.
Yes, that is how we met. Which is a great way to start a friendship between two Chicanos as activists. So perfect. But yes, that is a big part of why it was important to me to have you be episode 5, because part of what I've been doing is to tell this story about this historic civil rights case.
Yeah.
It's starting with the people that the housing march is really at the center of the case, but the story's a lot bigger. So we're starting, though, with the 6 of us who were arrested as a result of participating in protests that day.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then additionally to that, I also work at the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I'm the museum technician, so I do a lot of archival things, set up displays, do the research for historical exhibits.
Beautiful.
So kind of just an all-around historian and activist.
Well, then you're the perfect person for this show, right?
Right.
So, and especially, again, the personal lived experience part, which we're going to get into. But a part of this show, as we keep kind of saying, in case people are new to the show and catching us in the middle, is that there's layers to it. We want to tell the story of the case, tell the story of the community, especially the people impacted by it, and also hoping to leave people with more knowledge about, frankly, systems, right? The legal system. That's a huge one. And we're living that experience now. And then on top of that, also just uplifting, we're going to make time to uplift ourselves and talk about what's good in community as well. And so this podcast is a vehicle for the updates about the case. And so that's kind of where we usually start. And so there was a doozy that happened this week.
Yes, there was.
Yes, and we kind of collectively experienced a grief. I have in my notes here, big ouch, which is the understatement of the century, but we live in a strange time, so all of it's understatement, really.
Sure,
but,
yes.
We mentioned it already as we were talking, but if you want to chime in on additional thoughts, I'm going to let folks know that this Wednesday, April 10th, the judge, U.S. District Court Judge Cato Cruz, did make a ruling or an order in our case. And there had been a motion or motions to dismiss filed by the government and the police that we're trying to hold accountable. That's a pretty typical process in the legal system, pretty standard.
Yeah.
And so we had talked about in several episodes, we were waiting to see traction either way on those because that was, you know, hanging over our heads.
Yes.
And really regrettably, this decision came out that the judge granted those motions. And thankfully, you know, we have an incredible organization like the American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado leading this case for us. And so just on a personal note, and glad to have you chime in, Alex, is that was really quite devastating for me. I did not handle the news well. And it was a moment where just thinking about everything that we went through, how deeply I was violated, how that could be really dismissed, like that's really the language that they use, right? Yeah. Was incredibly painful. And right now we're in a time, frankly, when people's trust in the courts, whether you want to look at the Supreme Court or the highest state court in Arizona, taking the people in that state back to the 1800s,
right.
And making women second-class citizens again by banning abortion under some civil, the Civil War era law that they're using, like, courts, I think, are losing faith. And so this was a really tough one.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, I think we'll get to it in a second because I want to share the ACLU statement on it.
Yes.
But all
which
that
I
is
actually
to say,
haven't heard yet because I've
okay. You've been busy
been
with your personal life.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we'll get to that. But I want to hear from you about that as well. And I think the only other thing that I want to say on like having that experience is it's incredible to me if you read this opinion, which I don't expect people to because it's like 41 pages and it's legalese. But to me, it was like, okay, so if everything that happened to me and us was permissible, then, you know, when is someone like Donald Trump's, all his electronic devices, every single thing that he owns, when is that getting confiscated?
I mean,
is what I, we one all, of my takeaways.
We all know that the rich are held to a different standard than everybody yes. else in this country. So,
and the fact, I do think the fact that he is a white supremacist has to do with some of how the legal system has treated him.
Oh, sure.
In combination with the fact that he's wealthy.
Yeah. Right? I mean, there's great historical arguments that our current legal system is a product of Jim Crow laws.
Indeed.
A lot of these racist neighborhood organizations and mm-hmm. neo-Nazi and KKK groups, they just legitimize themselves mm-hmm. into more mainstream organizations and local government. So,
point well taken there as we go into an election this year, a mm-hmm. presidential election. And so another piece of, again, why this case is so important and how really court rulings are, they can either be for the benefit of democracy or be extremely dangerous, mm-hmm. right? And so in this case, too, is that one of the claims in this case is that the FBI took all my data. Every single electronic device that I own, they copied
it. Oh, I know. You were put through the ringer.
Thank
you. I mean, they
yeah.
harassed the hell out of all of us, but they really put you through the ringer.
It was on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the message that they were trying to send, mm-hmm. right? And so that's another reason why this case is important, because if the FBI can do that to anyone, take a whole copy of your entire life, because we all basically live digitally now, and you never be convicted of a crime,
mm-hmm.
which is the truth about my case. And the accusations against us, right? And have no accountability, that they have to give my data back or destroy it, is what we have asked for. So big things related to our case, but I'll stop there. Any other thoughts on what was a tough week?
Honestly, I'm still processing a lot of this. We got the news Wednesday morning. It was a terrible way to start the day. I don't know about you, Jax, but I felt physically ill.
I had a 24-hour headache. Yeah, it would not go away.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it didn't get better that day. It just was more information that we weren't hoping to hear, that's for
right.
sure.
Right, and this is one of those hard moments as activists where, you know, I guess there's just a balance to life, but it's like you get knocked down 9 times, you get up 10, but it hurts. It mm-hmm. doesn't stop it from hurting.
Well, I mean, our entire experience, your entire experience of all this heartache and harassment that we went through, it's almost like it means nothing.
Dismissed?
But, yeah.
Yeah, not cool.
All not for anything. I mean, of course, we'll pursue whatever legal actions we can if there are options to.
Indeed. Well, that's where the ACLU comes in, right?
Right? Yeah.
And so speaking of probably some the info that you had been aware of, too, as a Chinook Center board member, is that recently we had a bit of a win.
Mm-hmm.
We had a decision. There are two judges on this case, which, again, is our lived experience of this is like, how is that even a thing?
Yeah.
There's the magistrate judge, which is the one who granted this order, the motion to dismiss, he's the U.S. District Court judge. That's Cruz. There's a magistrate judge who's kind of like a co-judge, for a layman's term. She's the one who had said, hey, City of Colorado Springs, there is more documentation that you need to provide mm-hmm. to the plaintiffs. And so This puts the brakes on that as well, unfortunately. Finally, here's the statement that ACLU sent to our local newspaper, which I thought their article was pretty lackluster, and they didn't even mention the show. Mm-hmm. It's like, geez, there's some local people that are talking about this in real time. Literally, the person whose name is on the case. So they didn't, I guess, I don't know if they don't know. So the ACLU said to the Gazette, "We remain steadfast in our case against the Colorado Springs police officers, the city, and the FBI. We believe the court ruled incorrectly. The dragnet warrants issued and executed by local law enforcement were an affront to fundamental rights of privacy and free speech set forth in federal and state constitutions. We will investigate next steps to ensure Ms. Armendariz Unzueta," that's me, "and the Chinook Center can get the justice they deserve and prevent law enforcement from continuing to violate people's rights." So really, la lucha sigue.
Well, I wouldn't expect anything less for them. I do know that we have a couple tenacious people working on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a couple. I think all of them. Yeah. And mad shout out to them. I know we have a connection to kind of, we have professional political experience. So I think looking through it with that lens as well of what the greater context of what is going on, you know, gave it some extra teeth this week. But we're still here. We're not fucking going anywhere.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's true. We did kind of run in those same circles for a while. And how did you get started? What's brought you into the fold initially?
Of politics?
Yeah, because I know we had a similar journey, like going mainstream and then becoming disillusioned with a lot of it.
Somewhat. Well, it's funny. I mean, people talk about your moment of radicalization, right, as an activist. And it's like, gee, you think the FBI busting up in my house along with CSPD and putting me in blackout mode with no electronic device access whatsoever, throwing me in the county jail, ruining my career with a second degree felony accusation, you think that was my moment of radicalization? And so, but really it started, I was a journalist. That's how my professional career began. And I did about 10 years in newspapers. I'm originally from the border, El Paso, Texas. And I reported for a number of papers, both on the far west and down to the deep south. And Texas, coming from there, what an influence. And after that time in newspapers, I was so disillusioned, frankly. Mm-hmm. That I said to myself, I think I want to be someone who isn't like a neutral observer, because that is a public service too, obviously.
Yeah.
But I wanted to take more action. And so I started door knocking the Wendy Davis gubernatorial campaign, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking Greg Abbott. He's still there.
Yeah. I met her a couple of times. She's a very nice woman.
She's lovely. Yeah. I've met her a few times, too. And so she was someone who, for me, it called to me to support her. And once I guess, got a taste of being engaged that way, I decided to keep going. And I moved over. I left newspapers, went to public service at the municipal level, and used my communications background. And then I just kept getting more involved in political organizing. And when I came to Colorado in 2016, I actually became an organizer for the presidential campaign at the time for the Democrats.
Yeah, in 2016. 2016?
Yeah, and it was...
I was doing things the time. Then. I was just barely holding on by a thread in 2016.
Yeah. It was already really rough, yeah. And frankly, I had joined, if you recall, there was a primary. Mm-hmm. And I had joined to be a field organizer for the Democrats prior to Hillary Clinton becoming the candidate. And what it really was Bernie. I wanted the possibility of working for Bernie. And Barack Obama was the first president I voted for. I made some like calls for him, right? Virtual phone banking back then, which I'm really dating myself, but we're around the same age.
So I started in 08.
Yeah,
so
that's what I'm saying, 08, right?
Yeah.
And so I had heard about Barack Obama's history, and I was like, community organizer, that sounds kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Like an organizer, I want to try it out. In 2016, the opportunity presented itself. It was obviously a critical election. And I called it a beautiful nightmare, because as much as it can be fulfilling to organize your community, the political machine, and then of course we know the severely tragic outcome mm-hmm. that happened in the 2016 election. So I dug deeper because 2016 hurt so much, seeing a fascist, later, you know, convicted rapist, mm-hmm. now I consider Donald Trump a white supremacist, domestic terrorist, become our president. Sure. Ouchie. Big ouch.
You know, it's almost like the election night 2008 was the peak of hope for the country.
And then we had some
issues. And
then
issues. It just kind of went downhill after that.
It maybe went downhill from there little bit. Well, the good news is I think maybe we can ebb and flow. And here we are yet again in 2024, where the challenges of eventually having a two-party system and two candidates to pick from mm-hmm. continue to present themselves. So we shall see.
Yeah, and when you mentioned your moment of radicalization, I think I was always a little bit radical just because of my family background and stuff. My family's from the San Luis Valley. People like my Aunt Jenny Sanchez and my grandmother, Marcella Archuleta, they were very involved in the farm workers' strike, to the point to which that they were personal friends with, like, Corky Gonzalez.
And tell the people who Corky Gonzalez is, because that's a really important note for the cast. The
podcast. So a lot of folks don't know that Colorado was really critical during the Chicano movement, particularly in the 1970s into the early 80s. We were really, along with Texas and somewhat in California, were the main organizing hub.
That's right.
And one of the people who was at the forefront of this organizing in Colorado for Chicano rights was a gentleman named Corky Gonzalez, Rudolfo Corky Gonzalez. He was a former boxer, but was a very eloquent speaker and a natural organizer that actually only died at, like, probably 10 years ago.
We still have living legends among us.
So he was around for a long time. I believe he was into his
90s. They organized the Crusade for Justice. Yes, that was huge in Denver Metro in Colorado, right?
Yeah, it was downtown, actually near where the Auraria campus is mm-hmm. now. That was bombed, in mm-hmm. Corky Gonzalez's words. They were grenaded by the police after a situation where the police arrested a Mexican man for jaywalking.
Mm-hmm. Feels like history repeats itself in some ways, right? And so, no, thank you for taking a beat on that. And actually, let's link it up to an important part of why I wanted to spend this time with you, is talk about the case in your personal experience, because you were the fifth person that was arrested, and you had some allegations against you as well. So as much as you like, tell the people what your experience was and your view on the legal system from that seat.
Sure. So the March for Housing, it was not my first protest.
Me either, right?
Yeah. I mean, we are just coming off Black Lives Matter, and I'm no stranger to the activist world. And I'll be the first one to tell you that I've been a part of some pretty contentious protests before. This was not one of those.
It wasn't on our part, but no. I think once we got there, then we started getting a sense of how it was so different from CSPD.
When they came after us with armored vehicles and such.
Yeah.
To me, this was a beautiful buildup to a beautiful thing. The night before, we organized at the community center, put together sack lunches for the unhoused people. The entire community came together to help with that. Mm-hmm. I have pictures still, and they're wonderful. They're people of all genders, sexes, races coming together to assembly line peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So I was just ready to enjoy that day. I wore my
Birkenstocks,
my famous Birkenstocks, were lost.
Because you don't wear those to protest.
No,
that's
you
the
never.
Joke.
You don't never. Wear you that always wear good shoes because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
And I do remember getting up that morning and looking at my feet and being like, "Nah, I mean, nobody's against this.
Why would you be against housing for all?" Right. Which remains a crisis in our country. Right. Let's not forget
city, especially.
Yeah. 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 And so we were happy, enjoying the summertime sunshine, wearing our Birkenstocks.
In fact, I was in the back playing drums on a bucket. I'm just having a great time. I had a few of my students around me, teacher at UCCS, and Police showed up, full armored vehicles, full riot gear, big weapons. I don't know guns very well, but they were big. Blocked off the street. We moved to another street that was adjacent. They blocked off that street as well. Right. Mind you, this is for a group of maybe, I don't know, 30 people, 40 people. Small group as far as protests go.
And what really hurt was that it was a group that was so diverse in the sense of, like, yo, there were kids there. There were elderly people there. Like, we were not the domestic terrorists that they thought we were in their minds, you know?
Yeah, and things escalated rather quickly because of the actions of the CSPD. Right before, I believe, they started attacking Sean Walls and taking him down because he was in the front. I was in the back.
Well, he's the one that they have had their eye on this entire time.
He's the scary black man, you know? But right before, seconds before that had happened, a friend of mine who never had really gone to a protest before.
Oh, really? Oh,
boy. She just goes, "Are they getting arrested?" And I just say to her, "No, no." Then they'd start tackling him and being violent.
Yeah, they were super aggressive, super amped up.
There's video out there for those that are interested. But it escalated to the point that they were physically taking in several people. At one point, one of my students at the time, Charles Johnson was with me.
Episode three,
that's right. Charles Johnson, great kid.
Wonderful human.
Very proud of him and what he's been able to accomplish with his brother. But he was in the back having a very gentle conversation, especially considering what was going on, with a officer who happened to be the only black officer there.
We talked about that in this episode.
Inclination was to immediately stop him from talking to the police. However, and these are all split decisions you make in your head.
Which, again, we've talked about on the show, that everyone who received a charge, an allegation, we were being prosecuted for split-second reactions that we made when we were being aggressed upon by the police. It's almost like maybe they baited us or something, huh?
Yeah, so I made the decision to let them talk because they were having a cordial conversation. I looked at it as one black man talking to another black man about what was going on. It was kind. It was cordial. There was no situation that was erupting out of that whatsoever. And again, this is all in a matter of seconds. So I stand next to him and suddenly two police officers intervene and just yell, "You're under arrest." Again, I'm standing next to Charles. According to them, I tried to resist. So at that point, again, it's all on video. They punched me in the eye intentionally and threw me on the ground. And I had quite a big shiner for a while after that. After that all took place, of course, it was hard to process.
And they didn't actually arrest you there, right?
No, like you.
Yes. Yeah.
So we actually, myself and Sam Christiansen, we went down to the jail to try to find the people that were taken out. Yeah, but they weren't really processed. It was, I don't know what the situation or what you would call it. They were put in cuffs and they were taken somewhere. I call that being arrested, but they weren't at the jail. So who knows where they took him. But yeah, they didn't arrest me during the incident. Of course, I didn't do anything, so I wasn't expecting to get a call or receive notice that I was going to be arrested. So the way that that evolved was
They send you? It was like a municipal summons.
They actually began by calling my family.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm easy to find.
As am I. Yeah. That's the funny thing about this is like you could have just called FBI, CSPD. You didn't have to go wreck my house.
Exactly. Yeah. I had actually gone out of town to New York, and I come home with a lot of people within my family, my mother, my father, my grandparents, saying that they'd received all these calls from the police department wanting to talk to me, which is clearly a scare tactic on their part. Again, not hard to find. Mm-hmm. So that escalated into a family situation that, of course, exasperated everything.
Which is the point of this, which is, like, there's so much ripple effects and impacts that happen when law enforcement, an extension of our government, chooses to act this way, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, long story short, I was eventually charged with resisting arrest and I can't remember what the rest was, assault on an officer or something like
really?
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, that was interesting to me. Because, like, I don't know. We could look at the sensitive investigation.
I should remember that because they drug me through this for an entire year.
Right. But the interesting part to me that was also different was, like me, they came for you later.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were in municipal court, so that's why I'm like, I'm not sure, because I presume an alleged assault like mine, right? Mm-hmm. I presume that would be something that is bumped over to the district court. So I'm not sure. I don't remember. I didn't have the notes.
Yeah, I'll have to relook at those papers. But like you, went through this whole process for over a year, and eventually they dropped all of the charges the day before my trial would take
place.
That's
right.
Yeah.
So just to repeat that, I mean, repeat that in the camera maybe, is that the CSPD accused you of multiple crimes.
Yes.
Right?
Multiple crimes that carried jail time, potential jail time.
Yeah.
And they drug me through this process for over a year, which, of course, those of you know who have been through the legal system know that it has an incredible emotional toll on you.
Yeah.
Drug it out for over a year, only to the day before the trial was to take place to drop all of the charges. They were just trying to squeeze something out of me. They were trying to get me to confess to something I didn't do, anything.
Mm-hmm.
They were just really grasping at straws
point,
here.
Grasping at straws is a perfect word for it, because they feel like that can categorize every single fucking thing that they did with regard to why we have a civil rights case now. They were grasping at straws, trying to manufacture criminality for people who make sure that unhoused neighbors are fed.
Yeah.
People who open up a food pantry every Sunday. People who organize community bike rides in our neighborhoods. And that is really a detestable dynamic of this story, frankly, and needs to be called out.
Yeah, and I think it's important to talk about, too, how lucky we both were.
Privilege.
We both were to be able to fight this.
Yeah.
Most people do not have the resources to hire a lawyer, to go through this process for over a year. That all comes money out of your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why most cases settle with some kind of
a plea.
Some kind of plea.
Chinook Center paid my criminal defense attorney, thank God, and that was a privilege. I also have the privilege, frankly, in the fact that at the time, since I was a U.S. Senate staffer, I don't know many people whose jobs would put them on paid leave when the accusation of second-degree felony attempted aggravated assault on a police officer comes up.
Which just shows how ridiculous this charge was. The entire
There's
situation.
There's video of that, too. Yeah, simply just dropping my bike in reaction to seeing the police abuse my community and thinking, you coming for me?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, flash forward, what was that a shock to you when they, like, the day before? Because I remember what it was like to prepare to be like, holy shit, I'm going to go on trial. That just sounds horrible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what you say to people is like, I'm on trial right now, but it was going to actually literally happen to us. And I remember, you know, just the mental difficulty wrapping my head around that.
Yeah, it's a terrible experience. When we got to that point the day before the trial, I kind of had an inclination that might drop things because they didn't have an argument to make.
Right.
I mean, they're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll be honest, there was part of me that to that point had hyped myself up and was ready
to
go.
Yeah.
And I was a little disappointed that we didn't get to fight.
I totally get it. I had to do the same thing because they came for me several pleas and I said, no, I'm not guilty. That's how we got the body cam, right? And it scared the shit out of me because the risk was potentially being convicted of a felony, and here I am getting a deal I can't refuse. And mm-hmm. that's why upwards, is it 80-90% of, I think even criminal cases in our legal system have plea agreements typically. Yep. There's rarely trials.
Rarely, very rarely. Yeah. And I've been through that system before, and the emotional scars that you carry with you from that, it really never goes away.
Right. Yeah, that's a true thing. And so here we are.
But Jax, my heart goes out to you and fighting you. This. I mean, like you said, I was in municipal court. They probably weren't going to put me in jail even if I got found guilty, but they put you through the ringer, and they wanted blood with you.
It
and
sure Charles felt like that. And and that's why Charles and I were bumped over to that district court, mm-hmm. right? And that's certainly, you know, a part of why it was important for him also to us to have the space to talk about that experience. Because, yes, it is a ringer. I don't know if you know this. Charles, just recently, this is 2024, finally completed all the stipulations of what he was required to do with all that prosecution.
Oh, that's such a weight off his shoulder. Having been through things like that, that's a huge weight off his shoulder.
It was important.
Something he should never had to deal with in the first place. So,
truly. Yeah. Truly. And so, flash forward, you know, this hellish year that you had to go through, and then suddenly we were trying to still really bring accountability, right? Mm-hmm. And it took time to gain traction. And
it always does, you know?
Yeah.
And people fall off the ship because they think it's taking so long or nothing's going to happen. But that's key to being an activist. You have to keep digging. And this shit takes a long time in a lot of cases.
It is not flipping a switch ever, right? And it's multiple avenues. Like, especially with John, you know, we have so much overlap in our activism, but yet the complementary, like, we have different perspectives. But I think one thing we've all talked about, in a sense, is that, like, the devil's in the details. And so you think about these large, like, big picture concepts and stuff, and yet the details are obviously critical. And another thing is there are different avenues. And so this is only one of them, really, this litigation piece of things. And so do you remember what it felt like, or where you were, your thoughts around, like, holy shit, we're finally filing the case?
I was hyped about that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because it had been a lot of false starts. There had been a lot of talking.
We were in a lot of talking.
A lot of talking to various lawyers early on who said that, you know, there's nothing you can do about this. You know, there's.
Yeah, right.
Remember those? Yeah.
I do. I do. And that's the sad thing about the legal system, I think, that plenty of people experience, is that how many no's you get from just the act of trying to find a competent legal representative, a lawyer.
Totally.
And how most of the time you get a no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's another privilege we had. And I think an important thing to talk about with the lived experience of all this is, like, okay, we finally got the case filed. And as we were evaluating things and living through this, we realized, I want to take a beat to hear your thoughts on this, is we started to realize that the timeline of our prosecutions in both the municipal and district court was the same timeline, frankly, where our local authorities had the person who eventually became the Club Q shooter
in
custody the first time they terrorized our community, and yet that person was not prosecuted even by the 4th Judicial District at the time. And I almost every episode I'll probably say this, like, I'm not a lawyer, I just play one on TV, just kidding, I don't even do that. But my understanding, the analysis that I've looked into is, you know, the DA saying that, well, the people involved, like the family members seeing the eventual shooter terrorize the community for the first episode, they didn't want to testify. And it was like, so the body cam and all the audio you have, none of that was evidence?
Which I watched, and it is appalling.
Yeah. truly, truly. And this is because the person who became the club Q shooter about a year in advance of that had, like, called in a bomb threat in their neighborhood, was acting
like a real terrorist.
Was a terrorist. And I don't know if he had, like, kidnapped his grandparents or
But he didn't. He didn't give food to the homeless, though, so he's not a...
Never did that.
He's not a terrorist.
There's no record of that. Yeah, and so the fact that this happened on the same timeline, that was, like, for me, another layer of pain, because it just so blatantly showed what we're joking about, because sometimes you laugh to keep from crying, but just the vast difference between if you are affiliated with the far right, far enough to be a white supremacist domestic terrorist, you will get different treatment than people like us who are on the left and believe that really we were criminalized for believing that housing is a human right, Black lives matter, and white supremacy is domestic terrorism, and that made us a criminal in the eyes of CSPD.
Right, and going back to the shooter, like, to really just put it in simple terms, they knew about that guy, the mass shooter, that he was a threat and was making threats and doing terrorist type of actions prior to the shooting.
They knew he was a white supremacist.
They let him go almost in favor of keeping us in the system.
That's what it boiled down to, so, and that's why it hurt.
In the eyes of our local justice system, me, Jax, were more important to prosecute than somebody who would go on to kill multiple people.
Right.
I don't remember how many people died, but...
Five.
Another personal connection I have to that is my brother was supposed to be there that night. He lost a lot of friends. Thank God he has kind of a neat job where he works for the circus.
Wow.
So he travels, and he got called out to travel earlier that day and was unable to go. But it's appalling. I mean, it obviously making me very angry right now that they chose to pursue us, people who are trying to make a difference,
a
make good
difference
in the community, and let this terrorist go who would end multiple lives.
Yeah, you know? He murdered my friend's boyfriend, Raymond Green, and four others. Yes. And
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Equally, just the physical sensation of disgust, right, that comes from that anger. And so it's something that has been important, I think, to name in these conversations that we're having about the case and kind of this timeline that we've been operating in. And so I think another thing, you know, to touch on is we have a little bit, but speaking of timelines, as two people who have had professional experience in politics, and I want to name two before I forget this thought, is, and I mentioned it, is like, we are Chicanos, Chicano, who are white passing. We have privilege in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even in these systems, like, I can't help but think in my gut, like, does my name, like, it's seen on paper and already that's a bias against me. And to be, you know, perfectly candid with you, I didn't really go by Jax before these traumatic events, but I'm not the same person. And so I gave myself a new name as a way of kind of healing and processing this. And another thing I did is I became Arvindaris Unsueta, because in cultura, it's something I learned later, but in Mexicano families, we carry mom and dad's name.
Yep.
And I started to contemplate these things about white supremacy and our systems and stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm going through the darkest time in my life ever. I'm going to change how I refer to myself, how I see myself. And I became Arvindaris Unsueta because I wanted to honor my ancestors and call them to my side to protect me and give me strength.
Absolutely.
During one of, like I said, the hardest things I've ever been through. And so I love that about our commonality, because cultura is important to us. And it's something that I think I can speak for myself, love to hear from you, but it's something that has always powered me. And as a result of going through this crazy ass shit, I have only found more richness in leaning into that. And so we have these shared backgrounds a little bit. We're living in this weird timeline. Some might call it the time of monsters.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about your thoughts and we've touched on it, but I want to go deeper, just that at the highest levels of our systems, our legal system, our political systems, we have someone who will be one of the party's candidates who he called for a coup on our democracy. And yet his electronic devices don't get confiscated despite, you know, the 91 or whatever.
He's still on the ballot. He's still...
Right. We tried to take him off the ballot in Colorado.
I know, and they overturned... God bless Colorado.
God bless Colorado. Sure.
Super glad that I live here.
I am very grateful to be a Coloradan. Let me just repeat that. Absolutely.
Although I told my because my brother's traveling in the circus, mm-hmm. I told him to register to vote in Florida. Because he's based out of there a
whatever
lot of the time.
If he meets the residency requirements,
he does,
right?
Yeah, he does.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so...
Which I know because I worked in that for a very long time.
Exactly. That's where we vibe. We could talk about voter protection.
Also, voter fraud does not exist. Sorry, how do you get that off my chest?
Get it out. That's what this podcast is for. And so, just for me, it's been a painful thing. And I can always try to strike a balance because the connections that we have, the solidarity that we have, that's a beautiful piece that can balance these things out. But it's been tough for me to look at what's going on with Donald Trump and white supremacy and the alt-right and the J6 people being, what are they calling them, hostages or whatever?
Yeah.
And then looking at our case and being like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, that's what actually happened to us, and how dare you use it as a cover for your bigotry and your maliciousness and your hatred.
Exactly.
Really. Tell me more, Alex. How do you feel about that?
Well, one thing I'm thinking about is you said you couldn't help but feel that your name had some kind of impact, your last name.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely did.
Right?
As did mine. That reminds me of a little story only right before COVID, you know, 5-6 years ago, I had bought a desk off Facebook Marketplace,
mm-hmm.
and it was on Fort Carson. Mm. I didn't look at that before I agreed to buy it.
It might have changed your mind.
It would have changed my mind. I am not a fan, just because of the process they put you through and stuff.
Certainly, yeah.
But when I got there, I brought my brother with me, too, to help me. And they put us into, like, separate screening rooms,
oh, wow.
and were holding us. We were in there for a good hour and a half before they let us in, finally.
Yeah.
And finally, there was a young woman who, by the way that she was acting in her body language, she was appalled about what was going on and felt a moral obligation to tell me that.
Wow.
Chance,
that doesn't seem to happen too often with that sort of thing. Yeah.
We went out of the view of the cameras and stuff, and she goes, you know why they're not letting you in? And I go, well, I can guess why. But she goes, like, no, it's your last name.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've flagged all Mexicans' last names during that period, at least. I don't know if it's still like that.
Yeah.
So you're automatically detained.
Mm-hmm.
Our last names absolutely have an impact.
And that's the hard piece, because for us, we know that. We've lived that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you speak it in other circles, or if you speak it to, like, an at-large audience, you feel like... you are bananas. Like, and there are definitely some people who will be totally dismissive of that as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I felt it in my gut, and I've felt it in this community. I come from the frontera. Like, we're all good luck flagging every Hispanic last name there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference here. And I think that a piece of taking on, you know, a fuller identity, I would say, and the power of my ancestors, definitely another piece of it was like, oh, you mad? You mad because my last name is Arvindades and it has one Z? Well, guess what? Now I'm Arvindades and Zeta, and it has multiple Zs, and it is going to make you feel weird, and your tongue is going to have to try,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have to just try, you know?
It's true.
Yeah.
But I love that. I think that's just a wonderful thing to do that, and to come out of this all with a positive outlook and putting that negative energy into something that's impactful.
Like this show. Yeah, that's the idea.
Tip my hat to you for that.
Thank you, Alex.
Because not everybody can do that.
Not everybody
can come out of this not mortally wounded.
Right. And I have really been mindful to do what I can to, again, strike the balance. And that's something that I've always said, we want to talk privilege, and I know my privilege. I would rather it be me. I like, when I started hearing from the community about their experiences with CSPD and how they'd been treated and they felt targeted, retaliated against, you know, the feedback that I was getting was like, I'm so glad that you can fight, but I have kids, and that was never, ever going to be an option for me. Mm-hmm. And that is so real and valid. And so if not me, then who? Like, I would rather it be me for those people who had less privilege than I could leverage to get to this point. And really, the journey continues, because as we mentioned at the top, the updates that we have now, ultimately, obviously, investigating the options going forward, and what does that mean? More mm-hmm. time. This journey has likely been extended. Yeah. And so, that being said, any other thoughts about the time of monsters? We are the warriors showing up to do battle.
you made a really good point there. You know, rather than it be somebody who has a family, you know, doesn't have resources, we are people.
Could lose their job.
We are people who have resources at our disposal. Even though it may not be astronomical resources, we do have people that if we disappear, they'll go looking for us. You know, we're not undocumented. Mm-hmm. You've seen how they treat them in jail. You know, for everybody in jail holding, you're basically sitting in a glorified waiting room. I remember one time I watched the State of the Union while I was in jail.
That's surprising. Wow. Well, I wish the jail here would let people vote. Anyway.
Unless you were immigrant, they chained you all together like it was the 16th century.
Yeah, some ugly things. Well, let's add some more balance to that, because we're getting kind of to the final portion of the show, which mm-hmm. I always think is really important. That balance piece is like, what's good in your life? What's good in community? What do you want to share that you're working on? Like, it sounds like with your affiliations, there's probably some cool things going on at Pioneers Museum. Obviously, feel free to plug Chinook Center a little bit more. But let's leave it on a what's good with your life note.
So you mentioned the Pioneers Museum. We're having a renovation done right now, which is going to go through a couple months. But that, of course, gives us a lot of time to plan. And we're putting together a women's history exhibit. Yay. It's going to be a whole room. I've been lucky enough to include some of the women in my family in it.
I can't wait to go.
Because we've been here for six generations, you know.
Speak on it. That's the thing. That's another thing. Like, a whole other podcast is like Latino or Chicano identity, where there's this narrative about us that we're newcomers, or all Latinos are immigrants. And it's like, actually, a lot of us have been here for multiple generations.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Spanish kept good records.
Right. Oh, well, now we're going to bring in colonialism and talk about that complexity of what it means to both honor that we have a mix of colonizer blood, indigenous blood, the people who've been here, and we're mixed, right?
People who did things that make the Holocaust
look
like. Yeah.
I don't want to use the wrong word, but the Holocaust was literally, that's why it's called the Holocaust.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you stack that up with what the atrocities colonialism has, you know, perpetuated across the world, that's some deep, like, you're probably familiar with epigenetics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so what that is, the concept that the traumas that we experience can live in our DNA, and that is something that Chicanos like us, that is something that is a part of our identity, and I think deliberately why we identify as Chicano.
Yeah, it's sometimes it's hard to balance those two histories, you know?
Truly,
They call us all kinds of things over the years. I've called myself different things over the years, but the thing that fits me, who I am personally and what my background is, also what my shared experience as an activist is Chicano. And I was very lucky in my background to have people who also felt that way, mm-hmm. Who raised me from a young age to be like that. So like I said before, I was always a little bit radicalized.
Good. Well, hey, more of that. Yeah, and I shout out, I'll say the same, you know, from my upbringing, because I come from a family, maybe they didn't necessarily identify as Chicano, but the idea of being an active participant in your democracy as a little girl, bringing me into the voting booth. Mm-hmm. My dad spent 20 years in Communication Workers of America, served, I think, at least 7 years, like, as an officer. And so I grew up in union meeting halls. Like, it's, you start them young. Yeah. That's what we got to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Because look what you get. It's me and you. Great. Perfect. So, but that said, any other plugs we want to do for what's good in your life or community while we have you?
I mean, obviously at the Chinook Center every Sunday, 12 to 2, we have People's Grocery. Come in and get a... I keep hitting that.
It's
sorry.
Okay.
Get a free bag of groceries that will last you the week. And again, we do that every Sunday. Other than that, you know, just trying to, you know, I feel like I'm still decompressing from the whole situation that we just talked about.
Seriously. You know? Yeah. I can't believe it was like 40, 72-ish hours ago, because if you had seen me on Wednesday, I'm not going to get into details, but I just will share, this is a plug for mental health awareness, is that it was a moment that was so severe for me that I was like, okay, I need to not take any more time in making sure I'm connected to a healthcare practitioner and doing what I need to do to take care of my mental health, and everyone deserves that as much as we can.
Yeah, good plug. I also made a telehealth appointment, and it was very helpful talking to a mental health professional during that. So yeah. I know that's a thing with guys. It's less so a thing with guys. But, yeah. I mean, mental health is just as important as your physical health.
Yeah, right. They're
and we got to maintain it just like we do our physical health.
The idea of a homeostasis, right? The mind-body connection. It's mm-hmm. all systems that are working together. And so as we go through this, yet another thing that we are living through as this experience takes us on these, like, ups and downs. Because you're right. Like, I go, like, into show host mode. But you're right. We are still processing, and I think coming out of those, 72 hours, wherever we're at, having the team of ACLU, I feel a little bit better, but I am preparing for another time when there may be some tough news, and we are going to get knocked down, and we're going to get back up.
Yes, because we have to. We've done it before. We'll do it again.
Yes, sir. And on that note, there we go. We've done it before. We'll do it again. So I'm going to close out the show as usual. Thank you so much, Alex, for joining us here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's sorry I kept pleasure. Bumping that microphone around.
So. It's all right. But that is a good plug for episodes of Justice with Jax being recorded here as a member of the Studio 809 Podcast Collective at the Next Desk Community Co-working Space in downtown Colorado Springs. So thank you for the space and the wonderful equipment. And then, as always, there are two questions to ask yourself. One is, who is telling your story? And two is, how are you being the change you want to see in the world today? So, this is Justice with Jax, signing off.